Thank you, I guess. Nice to be here. You have to be somewhere. Yeah, for 4 years, I was President Reagan's chief bureaucrat, the head of the civil service. Can you imagine that? Yeah, I wrote a book that was called Does Freedom Work? That several free markets economists called anarchical. And this is the man Ronald Reagan put at the head of the government's bureaucracy. He truly has a sense of humor. I remember when he asked me to do it, I said, gee, that sounds like a great job, the head of the civil service. And he said, I only want you to do three things. I want you to fire them, I want you to cut their benefits, and I want you to make them work. I said, thanks a lot. That should make me a lot of friends. Well, I went about and did it. It was called on the front piece of the Washington Post magazine, Reagan's Terrible Swift Sword of the Civil Service. I was called combative. I was called the Grinch in the pinstripe suit. I was called the Rasputin of the reduction in force. No, I didn't make a lot of friends. I always remember, though, what Harry Truman used to say about Washington. If you need a friend in Washington, buy a dog. I bought two of them, and I set out to do the job. Tell you something about these dogs, though. They were real conservative dogs. Had a good sense of the importance of things. Used to send one out for the Washington Post each morning and alternate them. One of them used to bring it in shredded each time, and the other one brought it in wet. He was my favorite. And these were tough dogs, too. If they liked you, they didn't lick your hand, they let you keep it. Yeah, the president gave me a tough job, but it's a very strange place and a very strange set of rules. People are told not to work. I found it interesting, the discussions about South America in the previous session. I thought he was talking about the bureaucracy in the United States. It is different. Now think of it this way. Where else, except in Washington, would they name the department that's in charge of all outdoors the Department of the Interior? It's a very strange place. Billions, millions, all confused. And I was supposed to go in and do something about it. But I did it, as the president said, with compassion. You may think he's just laying it on a little thick. But I really have a liberal heart. I have it on a jar in my desk. And yeah, when I did it, I wasn't confirmed as a result of what Dick Lesher, the head of the Chamber of Commerce, the U.S., called Washington Warfare. And then they did it again for Brad Reynolds, in case you didn't get the message the first time. And they've been holding up scores upon scores, the point that we have more than one-third of the presidential appointment jobs in the government not filled. The message was pretty clear to anyone that wanted to hear it, and that is, we don't hire presidential appointees to make any changes. Your job is to go along with the status quo. And if you don't, you're going to be out of a job. Really, when we look back at it, in the 1960s, how strange it was that John Kennedy was able to relate the welfare state to the idea of change. You know, there's nothing more inimical to change than the state, and probably especially the welfare state. It serves the institutions of power through its interest group politics. It creates its bureaucracy with the central motivating factors of inertia and caution. You have a media that exposes everything that's done and will guarantee that if anything is done, it will be pilloried. And all of its incentives are not to do anything. That's the same for liberals or conservatives. FDR complained about the bureaucracy, Kennedy. But of course it's worse for conservatives in this sense that at least FDR and Kennedy were increasing government, and where we're decreasing it, all the natural resistance of bureaucracy is magnified 100-fold. President Reagan knew what he was doing when he went in. He knew what he was up against. The first act he took, if you remember, it was before he left the Capitol, when he took the oath, was to put a freeze on federal employment. He set me to administer that, to cut back the size of the domestic government, to do more with less, to do it with fewer people. With the dissatisfaction that's set in because of the reverses we've had the past 4 years, it's critical to remember how successful we were that first year. Controllable non-defense spending went down 10% our first year. The next year, because it takes an extra year to catch up with entitlement, the growth went down by half. And I was very proud to be part of the fact that we reduced non-defense employment by about 100,000. 15 departments, agencies, and commissions on the domestic side reduced their employment by 10% or more. Department of Education, Housing and Urban Development, OPM, that's me, General Services Administration, Labor, HHS went down by more than 15% each. And you know, the amazing thing, by cutting down, we actually did a better job. I could see it best in OPM where we could measure it. We cut out 1/4 of the people working there. 25% fewer people when I left than when I came. And the fact of the matter is people were bumping into each other. They were creating the inefficiencies. Since OPM is an internal management thing, I didn't have the opportunity to cut any programs out completely, except one where we were giving grants to state and local governments, telling them how to run their personnel system. I thought since we didn't know how to run ours, we had some nerve telling them how to run theirs, so we cut that out completely. But there were only about 8 people Involved in that operation, it's pretty easy to sit down and write checks, which is basically what they did. So a very small proportion, less than 1% of what we cut, went out with program change. All the rest was simply running it better. And we found that all of our measures of productivity were up. And that was duplicated in many agencies across government. We changed the view of cost. Before, the idea in government constantly expanded. And although we were not as successful as I would have liked after the first 2 years, the fact of the matter is we did change the nature of the way government viewed the future. They couldn't be assured of constant growth, and it made them at least try to do the job with an idea of some limited resources. We did some spectacular things, really, in one sense, very simple things. But to give you an idea of how much, just in the management sense of government, and I'll talk more about fundamental issues as I close, but just some simple things and how you can save incredible amounts of money by making simple changes if you want to do it and you don't mind getting kicked around a little to do it. One of the programs we supervise is an early retirement program. When one of our agencies was going to lay off people, and as I say, we did lay off a decent number of them, we would allow people to retire early so that some younger people could stay on the job. Basically a good idea, but like so many things in that strange city of Washington, it became a game. What the agencies would do is they come in and say, we're going to have layoffs. They get the authority from OPM to have the layoffs, and then they come back later and say, we were only kidding. We didn't need any layoffs in the future. And all they were doing is finding a way to get rid of dead wood and increase the expense of the retirement system. I didn't think that made sense, so I made a very simple little change. Any third-year student in grade school could have come up with it. What he said is, you got to prove you're going to have layoffs. That one little change saved, in the 4 years I was in there, $160 million. Well, really, to be honest with you, that's really peanuts in Washington, $160 million, although I wouldn't mind it. But you know, one thing we conservatives talk about is how spending grows on each other. You know, savings grow on each other, too. If you calculate that out over the five-year budget cycle that we use, that adds up to $964 million. That's almost $1 billion. But that simple, simple change, that all it took was someone to say, I want to do this in some rational way. A second thing, and this is mind-boggling, one-third of our retirements in the government were on disability when I went in. Now think of that for a minute. We're white-collar employees, by and large. We got a couple of people that jump out of planes at 500 feet, but most of them, you know, are moving paper back and forth. One-third of the retirements were on disability. Now, somebody must have seen that before I got in there. The difference is, I did something about it. I looked at it, and I found out we didn't require any proof. Well, naturally, you're going to have a lot of disability retirements if you didn't ask people to prove they were disabled. Then we had a definition of disability where you basically had to be more healthy and a better worker after your sickness to come back to work than you were before. I did two things. I changed the definition of disability, actually to a very liberal one used in the Rehabilitation Act, and I required proof. And you know what happened? Disability retirements went down 58%. 58%. I saved During the 4 years I was there, $1.2 billion by that one decision. And over the budget cycle, that adds up to $4.9 billion. That ain't bad. I'll take a third example. One of the first crises I met when I went in was in the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. One of the first things, I was there maybe a month and a half, my equivalent, the vice president in charge of this, came up and he said, we're $440 million short on our health insurance system. I said, almost a half billion dollars short? He said, yeah, it's no problem. I said, it's no problem, a half billion dollars? He said, yeah, it's no problem. Just ask for more money. Well, I said, aren't people going to get upset about that? I mean, we just had an election, right? Reagan came in a landslide saying we're supposed to be taking care of money. He said, nah, it's no problem. Nobody's ever heard of the program. If you're honest, you'll admit none of you in here have heard it. And it's the 15th largest entitlement program in the government, $6 billion a year program. Nobody's ever heard it. He said, people aren't going to complain about it. Well, that makes sense. I said, well, what about the employees? Part of your program is you're going to have to increase the premiums by 25%. I said, well, that's no problem. Yeah, we have sophisticated federal employees. They all know politics. Last year was an election year, and we purposely kept the premiums down. They know that. We make them happy in election years so we can get their vote, and they expect that the premiums are going to go up substantially the year after. In fact, if you don't let them go up, they're going to think they were gypped out of something. Which, in fact, those of you who were near Washington know that they were a little upset about it when I did something about it. But then he came with the kicker. I said, what about Congress? Aren't they going to get upset? And he said, they're covered by it. Well, I said, that isn't why I came here. Go back and tell me how we're going to deal with this. And I waited a week, 10 days. I hadn't seen the guy at all. I sent one of my political guys around to try to find him and grabbed him and brought him up to my office. I said, what are you going to do about this? You got a half billion dollar problem. He said, well, you're going to have to make the decision next week. You don't have enough time to do anything about it. I said, you could have told me that 10 days ago. Give me at least 10 days to do something about it. He said, well, there's nothing you can do about it anyway. Well, he didn't work for me long after that. I took the program over myself. Fortunately, I had some training in this area, but it didn't take a lot of brains. I found out that we're giving basically first dollar coverage on hospitalization. We had very little cost sharing anywhere else. So all I did was put in deductibles and cost sharing under the principle that if you have to share some of the cost, you're going to conserve some of the resources. A simple one, something I was taught not only in economics courses, but when I learned insurance. Now, you know, an interesting thing happened with that. The town went crazy. What is this guy doing cutting back benefits? You're not supposed to do that. Well, of course, I wasn't really cutting benefits. What I was doing was structuring the program in an economically rational way. An interesting thing happened. We have a thing in the government where we allow people to switch plans. A typical plan is built on market principles. It's a good idea. A typical area, maybe 20 different insurance plans you can choose between each year. The idea is to have competition to put it down. We call it open season. It's not when we hunt federal employees. I want to clear that up. It's when they can change their health plans. A million of them chose to go in plans which had higher deductibles and more coinsurance than I put in as a minimum. People act rationally, even federal employees. I saved them almost $1 billion in lower premiums by that decision. This wasn't just a taxpayer or management savings. It was a savings for all the interest involved, including the employees. But most importantly, I saved $3.6 billion during my 4 years in taxpayer's money. And that adds up to an overwhelming $13 billion over the budget cycle. I even began to attack what even the Washington Post liberal cartoonist Herb Black calls Washington's sacred cow, the retirement system. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but you know, the largest entitlement program in the government is Social Security. The second largest is Medicare. The civil service retirement system is the third largest entitlement program in the federal government. Got a $25 billion or so cash flow a year. You know, it has an unfunded liability of $518 billion. Now, you've got to be like me. I have these millions. Old Dirksen was right. He used to say, you spend $1 billion here, spend $1 billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. This isn't real because you can't conceive it. I mean, that's more than $500 billion. If we counted that as part of the federal debt, and by the way, anyone that thinks the federal debt is what we say the federal debt is living on the moon. They're talking about passing a $2 trillion debt. Now think of this, $518 billion is half a trillion. You know, do we have one quarter of the national debt? No, I mean, we're not even that bad. But think of it. One quarter of what we call the national debt is a debt in this one program alone. $500 billion. Want to know why? We let people retire on full retirement benefits at age 55 with 30 years of service. Now, in the private sector, almost everywhere, you have to be at least 62 to get reduced benefits and 65. And it isn't stoop labor either. And they have 100% indexing of the benefits to the cost of living. I don't know one program in the private sector that has that. Social Security is, and there are some ad hoc adjustments over that. But the government, we give 100%. But we used to be even more outrageous than that. We used to give cost of living increases twice a year. Glad we eliminated that. Some of you are shaking your head at that, but that doesn't even begin to explain what we have. We used to have a thing called the look back. And if I were them, I'd be looking over my shoulder with this too, because what it allowed you to do is not only pick up this year's cost of living, you can look back to the previous year and pick up that cost of living increase. And just because you were such a good guy, we also had a thing called the kicker, where you could get a 1% cost of living increase on top of that. Now that's cost of living protection with a vengeance. And that's why we have a $500 billion unfunded liability. Unfortunately, I didn't do a lot about that. I only saved about $2 billion there, because that truly is the sacred cow. And I came up with another crazy idea of paying federal employees based upon how well they perform. Imagine that. Crazy. They fought me. They've got all kinds of appropriation, right? I even lost track how many times they passed it through. Four times. I guess we finally went to the Supreme Court or something. Morris can tell you more about that. And I think it's in effect now, although I don't know if we'll ever implement it. Altogether, My one little puny agency saved $20 billion. Because I did it. And that's all it took. The guts to do it. There's no brainstorm ideas that I told you about here. Simple things if you wanted to do them. We did some things more important, really. We did make government more responsible, the bureaucracy more responsible to the leadership that's elected. Paul Taylor, not a big fan of mine, Washington Post reporter on his series on the bureaucracy, said that the Reagan administration moved more aggressively, more systematically, more successfully than any previous administration to assert its policy control over the top bureaucracy. Professor Richard Nathan of Princeton, a fellow political scientist, said that we did more to grab hold of personnel in the first term of the Reagan administration than any that he had ever seen. Even Senator Proxmire said that there's no question that Dr. Devine has done a good job in holding down costs. The head of an employee association who always wears a Democratic donkey tie pin, you can tell where he's coming from, and even though he disagreed with me in most of what he said, I'll give you credit though, Devine was one of the best heads of the civil service I've seen in over 40 years in Washington. And the reward, I got fired. Washington kills the messenger with the bad news. And you go back and look in your Thucydides, you see there's nothing new. People don't like to hear bad news. And the bad news from the liberal establishment's point of view was, yeah, I cut $20 billion, and we need to cut at least $20 billion more, and we've got to cut billions upon billions on top of that outside of the personnel system. Even conservatives don't want to hear that message, many of them. Congressman last night gave you a good picture of what we're up against in Congress. But even some of our leaders have called the Senate White House compromise budget, quote, draconian, unquote. Some of those who claim to lead our movement today talk about only needing growth. That we don't have to get all these constituencies and these power groups mad. We'll simply grow out of it. Well, growth is not enough. It won't solve the problem, never could, never will. It's important. It's got to be the first element in a successful conservative economic policy. But growth enough will alone will not do it. I got in this battle 25 years ago. I thought it was too big then. I'll be damned if I'm going to say that it's at its present size what it should be. And it'll just leave that in place and grow out of it. You know, we're not cutting the budget because we're mean and want to take money away from people. As President Reagan said, this administration is not cutting the budget simply for the sake of sounder financial management. This is only a first step towards returning power to the states and communities, only a first step towards reorienting the relationship between citizen and government. That's what it's all about. It isn't a question of being cheap on the money side. It's a question of returning the country to a rational political and economic order. And that can only be done is if we take this power of the central welfare state and move it back to the states and the communities so that we can have a government that approximates that which our great founders gave us. And there are all kinds of silly programs. Amtrak subsidizes trips for middle class, basically wealthy individuals. Job Corps training that costs more than Harvard. Appalachian Regional Commission, who supports $5 billion necessities like ski resorts.